Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 21, an interview with Kat Rocha and Josh Finney of 01 Publishing. About a year ago, one of the first interviews I did was with Kat Rocha and Josh Finney for the upcoming World War Kaiju. At the time, they were going through a Kickstarter. I thought it was a fascinating idea. And they were doing the rounds of podcasts, and I really hadn't done a lot of interviews. We had a great conversation. It spanned two episodes. And now that the book is out, I thought I would check back in with them to see how the Kickstarter has changed things. It took about a year for the book to come out, and they talk about the delays and the issues involved, all of which are pretty normal for publishing these days. But they also talk about how they have now formed their own publishing company. It's Kat's publishing company, and Josh writes stuff for it. Some of his stuff will get published, and some won't. And they get into that as well. We also talk about the state of science fiction, the state of comics, comic conventions, comic book journalism, other journalism. It's a wide-ranging discussion. Josh and Kat are very opinionated folks, and I like that in an interview. I like that they put their opinions out there. They also talk about who they are publishing for. So I hope that you enjoyed this interview. You will notice that it cuts off rather abruptly. And the reason for that is the artist for World War Kaiju calls in and wants to become a part of the discussion. And I figured since we'd already gone about an hour, bringing him in, that would be a separate episode. That episode will be available next week.
And I think the first question I'm going to ask is, World War Kaiju is out.
Yes.
I got my copy. It's a beautiful book. It's the same size as a comic, but it's formatted differently. So it has that widescreen feel.
Right.
And the art is, the printed art looks much better than it did on the Kickstarter page, which makes me think my monitor's a piece of crap. But it's just, it's a fun book. It's got all these interesting ideas. And I wanted to ask, first off, how did the Kickstarter go? You guys were on like a mad tear of doing a kind of a podcast tour.
Yeah, I was actually very thrilled at just how receptive everyone was to the concept and wanted to get us on air. It had been a while since anyone had really jumped on something we'd done that rapidly. So that was kind of cool. It was a hell of a lot of work, but I don't regret a bit of it.
Mm-mm. Nothing to regret.
The Kickstarter, we didn't get any sleep.
No.
It was 2 months of just constant work.
Mm-hmm.
It was harder than doing the book.
Yeah.
By a long shot. But frankly, if it means not needing to go through all the hoops of a regular publisher and make, you know, fine. It's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to ask, because I've given to different Kickstarters in the past, some of which by some big names in comics that didn't succeed. And some of which are characters that do very well in back issue sales and trade paperback sales, and they want to bring the character back, and they just don't seem to get the traction. Do you think it was the fact that you were out there almost like, I always call it the talk show circuit? Robert Downey Jr. was promoting The Judge. He was on Howard Stern. He was on Letterman. He was on this. He was on that. He was on The View. He was on Today. He was on Fox and Friends. He just was on everything.
Yeah.
Was that what you think put you guys over the top on this?
Well, I think a lot of people either don't understand or, quite frankly, because it's hard, don't want to put forth the effort, is the second you launch a Kickstarter, it is a 24/7 job. Every waking moment, you need to be out there pounding the pavement, getting the word out, keeping it in people's minds. Because since you have 30 days, 60 days in our case, people will forget about you. They will see your Kickstarter and go, wow, that's something neat. I'll keep it in mind. And then they'll totally forget that you exist. And if you're not constantly out there reminding people, hey, there's this awesome book that, you know, you need to help out or you need to be a part of if you want to see happen, it's not going to happen and they're totally going to forget about
you. So in short, yes, the talk show circuit, was vital. And that is one of the reasons that I am constantly reiterating that we need a more vibrant and open press that's interested in looking into things other than just the latest set of scandals, controversies, and press releases,
mm-hmm.
because the press does play an incredibly vital role in the smaller publishers and the independent projects. Without the press, yeah, these things don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we want to get into comics journalism, I will give you a very brief idea of my history and my belief of it. It died in the mid-90s when no one gave a shit about the Comics Journal anymore.
Yeah.
Because then you had Wizard, press release, press release, press release, press release, press release.
And Goofy Action Figure Comics.
Yeah. Which actually, you know, those were probably the only lasting idea because most of the people working on that are now working for Cartoon Network.
Really? That's cool.
Yeah. Then you had a Comic Buyer's Guide, which was pretty much the same thing. Then the internet came along, and we were excited for a little bit because, ooh, here are these comic news sites. But you go to them, and they have the exact same verbiage because they're just printing the press releases.
Well, are we on air right now?
Oh, of course!
Okay, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if we'd done the intro or not. One of the reasons I've been very active in the subject that will not be named for safety reasons regarding another industry that's having a press problem right now is that exactly that. We in the comics industry, we are suffering greatly from a dysfunctional, if not thoroughly broken press, in my opinion. For us, when we first got our start in around, what, 2007?
2006, 2007.
Well, you know, the press was still the press. People seemed to actually read comics. People were interested in what was coming out at the time. And you had a lot of small sites with people who just loved the medium doing their own amateur thing. And, you know, maybe they didn't have huge traffic, but, you know, a couple hundred people, if you could reach them, that was a couple hundred people. It was a lot of work, but you get it out there, it made a difference. And for our first two books, Utopiates and Titanium Rain, having that press was vital to getting the word out. But inevitably, I don't know if it was just, as in the term of the world of podcasts, there was Podfade, where a lot of these shows just disappeared or ran out of steam. But then on the flip side, a lot of the online journals and podcasts got bought up by larger companies. And like the other industry that will not be named, they went to this clickbait format of the latest controversy and the latest press release. They're, you know, if it isn't getting people mad or if it isn't some horrible scandal, if it isn't just some goofy press release that's getting them payola, it does not get coverage. And it has been incredibly hard for us to get any attention from that end. I mean, if it weren't for people like you, I think we'd be in serious trouble. Also, in terms of World War Kaiju, because Kaiju is such a niche audience, there's that sort of fan-based press is alive and well, and it isn't bought out by big money and clickbait. And that community was more than willing to bring us in there, talk to us, highly supportive. So there was the infrastructure of a press to talk to and get the word out. I hate to say it, one of the reasons we are moving away from more and more comics-based outreach, you know, trying to reach comics fans through comics press, is it just doesn't exist. The audience isn't going to be reached. The infrastructure for the press doesn't exist. Really, our better hope is to reach other readerships that can be reached.
One of the things I do when I go through the numbers, because as a former retail person and our other podcast, The Crazy Comics and Stories,
which I have learned so much about.
We both worked in retail, and I can tell you by looking at the numbers, shops, the big shops are doing very well here in the Twin Cities. Our convention here, which we've had one media star in 26 years and a shop brought her in. People are going around, they're buying mini comics, they're buying this. But if I run the numbers in my head, my theory is that the comics market is a mile wide and an inch deep. You're going to have tons of people who are buying comics, but they're $4, $5, $7 each. So they're still spending $20 a week.
Yeah.
So instead of, I want all of this and all of this and all of this, it's okay, I'm going to get Captain America, Walking Dead, Massive, The Wake, Buffy, and maybe if I have some money left over, something that looks good. Rather than back in the 90s when my friend Joe's shop was really big, or even till about 2002, 2003, you'd have people who buying $50 a month
yeah.
was not unheard of.
Well, I think that was also, the speculation boom. Just everyone was kind of nuts for thinking that these books were going to be worth something. You had a lot of people buying the comics who weren't even reading them, thinking they were investments. What I feel right now is the biggest problem with comics, well, among all the many, is that right now the state of the market, or maybe not the market, the state of the readership, there are so many people out there that could be potential readers if only we reached them. And the way things are structured, that's not what's happening. I mean, specifically, everything Kat and I are doing right now is trying to reach audiences that aren't really being appealed to or catered to in comics, reaching out to audiences aside from the typical guy who's going to go to the LCS or the hardcore convention goer, because those people have been reached, they're entrenched, and I think they're a dying breed too, actually.
One of the things I wanted to ask about, over the last year since we last talked, you've formed a publishing company.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, let me put my foot down on that. Very clear. Let's make this clear to everyone. Going to get a little closer to the mic for this. There is a very common perception that this is Josh Finney's self-publishing venture, Josh Finney publishing Josh Finney Comics. And that could not be further from the truth. Actually, what this is I'm assisting someone. I do graphic design. I do some promotion. But first and foremost, I am now pretty much a full-time writer. I spend almost all of my time writing and then still doing a little art. I kind of miss some of the art. 01 Publishing is almost entirely Kat Rocha venture. She is editor-in-chief. She's the money person. I may make creative decisions with her. But at the end of the day, this is a publishing company Kat runs, and it's not just Josh Finney books she publishes.
It's my baby. And just cause we're married doesn't mean that I greenlight everything that he does. So
I was going to say, if he submits a novel and you reject it, is somebody sleeping on the couch for a week?
No, but,
okay.
We don't have that kind of relationship.
No, no, but I am his editor, and I will tell him when something's not cutting the mustard, so.
Yeah, actually, I'll run past things past through, so I'll say, yeah, this project really, let's not follow, why don't you, this project seems more promising than that one. Your time's going to be better spent on this one than that right now. It keeps me focused, because I've got tons and tons of projects under pans in the fire, that it's the choose the right one kind of thing.
I heard okay. The cats that are his thoughts.
Yes. And you know, occasionally I'll come to her with things that are just batshit off the wall, bizarre. And I'll give one, for instance, that she's like, no, that's a fun exercise, but no, that's not, we're not doing that. And just could, oh, forget it. Yeah, this is a show. It'll be entertaining.
Yeah, be entertaining.
Getting really sick and tired of the overt political correctness that's running amok right now, I purposely went out of my way to write a story that the idea was to be so offensive that the offensive themes became meaningless. The offensive language, the offensive themes, everything was just so over the top and so gratuitously repeated. But by the end of it, you're just thoroughly numb to the concept of things being offensive. It was a fun exercise. Like, no, this is never seeing the light of day. No, we're
well, yeah.
That stays in the notebook.
Well, the problem is that I read it. It's like, you know, that there are serious pieces out there that are just as bad.
It was me just letting off steam. So, yeah, that doesn't get published. Meanwhile, there's also the other thing where, well, I would like to think I've got a lot of ideas that are worthwhile, but it's picking which one that's going to be the most, viable?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things I'm about. One day into NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel mm-hmm. Writing Month. And when I mention that to people, and I mention that I do writing and podcasts and stuff, they go, oh, I've got a great idea for a book. And they'll, you know, tell me the idea. And I don't have the heart to say, that's great. I get 20 ideas a day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I write down 5 of them and I might maybe choose one or two.
See, that shows that you're a writer is you know how to kill the babies.
Drawers and drawers and drawers full of notebooks, right? With ideas on them. Yeah.
So it's not the idea that's the thing to come up with. It's sitting your ass in the chair and doing the work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly.
And I want to take that back to World War Kaiju.
Thank you.
In that you did this Kickstarter, and when you did it, you weren't really a publishing company. Since it came out, you've become one. So what was that journey like along the way? Did this Kickstarter make you say to yourself, we got to control our own fate, our own destiny? We got to be putting stuff out there that no one else is doing. How did you get to that
point? The way that we got to that point was, I can't take credit for this.
Basically, we decided, fuck this. We're going to cut out the middleman because, you know, and a lot of people go through this with publishers and other people like that. It's part of playing the game. We realized if we're going to be busting our asses, promoting our own work, putting forth all the effort, spending our own money to promote our own books, why have a middleman?
Covering our own convention costs.
Yeah.
Cover our own convention costs, cover our own spending costs. Why have a middleman? Do it ourselves. And I went back to school and I've almost got my business degree. I've got one more class to go. Woo! And basically I found that because of the situation that we are in, and I know that it's not for everybody. Also, I am more business minded where, you know, Josh is, of course, you know, the talent. You know, not everybody can do this. It's just better for us to do it ourselves and get out there. And, you know, again, if we're going to be busting our asses, it's for us and us alone.
And we get paid.
And we get paid.
Yeah. And that's a common problem in the, don't take this the wrong way, in the lower end of any media.
No, don't take it wrong at all.
It's
creative accounting is a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and even with, like, let's say you want to do a local TV show, the station may hire you and have you do the show, and it may do okay, but their budget is not going to change.
Well,
and they expect you to go out and sell ads if you want your budget.
Now, basically.
So now moving into this, your what was it? Kaiju came out 2 months ago?
September 4th, I believe.
September 4th. So you had a lot of activity within that year.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It should have come out in June, But, you know, the wonders of running a publishing company, we had delays.
Oh, God. That was like an experiment in Murphy's Law.
It really was. Anything that could go wrong did go wrong. First, our wonderful artist, Patrick, you know, he had, some personal things that he had to take care of, which delayed it, you know.
Had to leave his house.
Yeah. You know, he had to, like, move, like, in a night.
Ooh.
And it's like, okay, you know, that happens. Shit happens. You take care of you. And he was good. He was only off the clock for a week. So considering the shit that was happening in his life, that was amazing. And the work that he put out, as you have seen, is just fabulous. But then the printer that we had been talking to for over a year suddenly, like, just...
started taking our money for granted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and delayed the process for 3 weeks. And it's like, sign this. Well, I already signed this. No, you got to sign this now. Okay, fine, I signed it. Now can we get on with it? Send us the templates. It's like, no, now you got to sign this one.
They just kept creating delay after delay after delay, trying to string this along. And I won't say this on air because I don't want to get in trouble, but anybody want to know who gave us this kind of problem? It's a well-regarded printing company. Everyone thinks they're the best.
And maybe just our experience is one of those rare ones that just went to shit.
You come and ask me who it is because you need to know. They're not globally that great.
No. But we said after 3 weeks of being strung along and not even getting a template to lay out the book for their parameters.
After we'd been setting, pretty much what was having this ready for a year with them, working it out.
Yeah.
Last minute notice, we went to Print Ninja, had it to the presses within 3 days.
Yeah.
Great company. Print Ninja was awesome.
They were wonderful. And they had a printing error. You know, it's again, one of these things that just happens.
It delayed it, but they fixed it on their dime.
Yeah, they fixed it on their dime. They alerted us and said, what happened was the glue wasn't binding. So they had to adjust some things. And they said, okay, we're taking care of it. We fixed it. We're letting you know that this happened. You know, it's going to delay things by a week, but we can send you, you know, advanced copies if you need it for whatever events you've already got scheduled. You know, I mean, they were on it.
But then there was a dock worker strike.
Which is still going.
But the books finally arrived.
Yeah, they did finally arrive, but they were delayed by 3 months. And it was horrible. That's the other thing, going back to Kickstarters. If you're running a Kickstarter, be 100% honest with your backers. Let them know everything that is happening, even if you think it's insignificant, because they really like having those updates. I'm pretty certain I brought this up before, but so many people appreciated that, you know, when we told them, okay, here's the next delay, we got no complaints from anybody.
One thing that I've told a lot of people when they ask about doing Kickstarters, ask about doing comics in general, or any art form for that matter, is I say, don't think you're a rock star. Don't ever come at it with the rock star attitude. It's not all about you. You need to treat your fans excellently. They're the reason you exist. They're the reason you can do what you're doing. And for that reason, you know, so if there's a problem, you tell them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not getting their book on time, you tell them. You apologize. You treat your fans like gold because they are the reason you're afloat and why you can live this life.
Mm-hmm.
What's the other concept of you can sell somebody anything once,
mm-hmm.
but if you want to sell them things over time, you have to treat them well. You have to give them good service. You guys sent out, I lost count at around 70 updates.
Yeah.
Which really, as someone who was, you know, waiting for the book, made me feel like I was part of the process, that I was in as you went. Whereas there are other Kickstarters, and I won't mention the name of the big Hollywood producer who did it, who still hasn't delivered the DVDs that he promised 3 years ago.
Oh.
Who he gave 3 updates and then disappeared for a year, gave people their money back with the promise, you'll be getting these DVDs anyway, but you could go out and you can look on his IMDb, and he's gotten, you know, 15 other jobs since then. Meanwhile, the people who worked for him, the people who bought the DVDs, who wanted this stuff, you know, they get crickets.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it doesn't just make you go, well, this guy's a scumbag. You also start to question Kickstarter and the whole process.
Yeah.
But one of the things, like I said, that I liked, you guys gave updates along the way. You've also published things that aren't comic books in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to do a little plug for your Cthulhu book.
Whispers from the Abyss. Yes, it's our our Lovecraft-inspired anthology. We originally put it out as a Kindle-only book, digital, and it took off. It spent a good 9 months on Amazon's top 20 list consecutively. And we figured that, you know, it was so popular, we would go ahead and print it. And we did a Kickstarter just for the printing costs. I want to make that very clear. We did not use the Kickstarter to pay for the writers. It was strictly to pay for the printing costs. And
well, yeah, we've got a very strict policy that people get paid on delivery.
Mm-hmm.
If they deliver their work, they get paid.
And it's important to say that because, you know, volume one is currently available. You can order your copy through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, tell your local shop to get it through Baker & Taylor. But we're doing an open call for volume two now. So, you know, send your stories to us. You know, that'd be great. We'd love to read them. And yes, we pay on delivery or we pay upon acceptance.
Why do you think it is that Lovecraft's work has lasted so long? There are hundreds of other writers from that era who've just faded into oblivion. Their stuff hasn't been reprinted. No one knows their names. Why do you think Lovecraft has stayed in the public consciousness so long?
Well, I can give you a short and a long answer. The short answer is, 'cause that stuff's so cool. it's cool. I think the long writerly scholarly answer would be that, you know, for all of his weird issues and hangups, or probably maybe because of all of his weird issues and hangups, he really was thinking from a different place. And in a sense, he kind of was the first modern horror writer, in that he took horror out of the realm of just the boogeyman in the forest or, you know, the devil in our midst and created what was a functionally scientific and atheist universe filled with creatures that weren't supernatural. They were beyond our understanding and that they constantly were reminding us of our place in the universe of not being special, not being a God's sole creation center of the universe, but just another blip on the cosmic radar, and that there was a whole universe of events of grander and greater things happening that were indifferent to us. And I believe in our modern age, that resonates very strongly, because on the one end, a lot of people have this driving need to have kind of a magical or even religious thinking, but knowing what we know now and with the prevalence of science and the awareness that the internet has brought, that doesn't really work anymore. And so I think that speaks to kind of a modern anxiety that we all feel. That's really what it comes back to. I think also just the ideas he created resonated so well and were so influential that he was already in the cultural zeitgeist before people were really becoming aware of Lovecraft as an iconic figure that he is now. All through the 40s and 50s, all the classic Golden Age pulps and films then, which is robbing him wholesale. And then those ideas then were again brought back and popularized through the 70s and 80s. So, you know, John Carpenter's Thing definitely had that vibe to it. So did Prince of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of a few other films off the top of my head, but they're not.
Well, there were the actual adaptations like Reanimator and
the
Stuart Gordon stuff.
Yeah, they're the direct reinterpretations, and then also, believe it or not, the Chaosium games. A lot of people came to it seeing these Chaosium games, not realizing what it was, reading it and going, oh my god, these ideas are brilliant. And I get to offend everyone now. That's always fun. I don't think he's that very good of a writer stylistically. I feel most of his prose are kind of weighted down, kind of clunky. Occasionally he'll break from that and do pulp, and I think it's much, much better. But the ideas themselves, the concepts, were so ahead of their time and so brilliant, it didn't matter. It's endured. This is going to sound weird, but I believe that Lovecraft has really resonated with our modern era the same way that gray aliens have kind of resonated in the cultural zeitgeist, in that there are these things that are beyond us, but they're scientific creatures instead of supernatural or they're mythical, but yet they're not supernatural.
Well, it's like how with, Dreams of the Witch House.
The witch. Also, he was on the cutting edge of science. He was really on top of scientific development. Lovecraft, he was reading all the journals. He knew what was up. That witch was using quantum physics.
Yeah.
In her witchcraft.
One of the other things about Lovecraft I find interesting is everybody wants to play in his toy box. Even Stephen King has done Cthulhu stories, but it almost seems like writers just want to get into his toolbox and play. So as you guys both writing and publishing and working in that toolbox, how much fun is it to play with his stuff?
It's fun.
Very fun.
For myself, believe it or not, I would have to say that the ideas I come up with, I think, are always a bit more on the satirical or kind of reaching into the fact that these ideas are so fantastic and so brilliantly insane that that's kind of the aspect I go for in my writings that are in the mythos setting. Would that be fair?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's possibly because I don't really do well with magical thinking.
And for me, you know, I grew up with a very mythological background. I am obsessed with Egyptology, Greek myths, and, you know, these are mythos where the deities play with humans. They see humans as their playthings. So for me, having Lovecraft's creatures, you know, the Migo, my favorite Ngetherohotep, again, using humans as playthings, it translates very well for me. It doesn't matter that it's a strange creature that we don't understand or if it's a deity or whatnot. The whole point is they do not see humans as equals or something that needs to be protected or sacred, like in my experience with Christianity. And that's where I have the most fun. So
the other thing I find interesting about the Lovecraftian mythos and the way people use it is it's very much the horror that cannot be described.
Mm-hmm. The giant penguins. It's all about the giant penguins.
But we tend to go back and forth in horror, where we want to show everything, then we don't want to show much. And right now we seem to be, I think we're almost in the middle, swinging back to we don't want to see everything, because we've been so saturated with the gore effects, and because with the computer graphics we could do anything we want. And horror, we had the whole splatterpunk movement, which is we're going to describe the horror and as much as we can. And now it almost seems like we're going back to, okay, the thing that's in the dark that you can't see is scarier.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
If you watch Walking Dead, many of the scene, they show the zombies, but more and more it's there's something out there and we don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they play with that more. And of course, me being a huge fan of Twin Peaks, David Lynch lived there. He lived in that something is scary that you can't see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might also be why Lovecraft's stuff is starting to, it really feels like it's coming, bubbling up again.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It is. It's he's probably never been more popular.
Yeah.
But then I could tie that to why, his stuff operated on both a cosmic scale and on the, microscopic scale, where the horror was literally right next to you in the spaces in between.
Yes.
Or it was the entire universe itself was hostile and essentially out to get you. But in both cases, you know, if you look in the media today, you know, we've had real life events that have been horrific and hard for us to process that have happened on a grand scale. Death on an industrial scale as well. And then when you look in our films, and a lot of our filmmakers, which I deeply criticize this, figure, oh, well, we're in the post 9/11 condition. To really shock people now, you have to do a lot of destruction, which is ridiculous. That was the justification for that Superman movie.
Mm-hmm. Where everyone said, actually talked about this a little while ago. There's some stuff about that Superman movie that was completely accidental.
Yeah.
In that the director directing the human people, all the special effects were done later.
Okay.
And they were given more and more and more money, so they wanted to make the destruction bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that destruction was not in the script.
Interesting. Okay.
So you've got Superman not really reacting to the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are being snuffed in a minute, because it's not in the script when they had a camera on the guy doing it. So how much of that is us feeling that need to make destruction huge? And how much is it where, well, we can show an entire city being destroyed.
Well,
it's only $1 million more. Come on.
That's what I'm getting at, is that Hollywood itself and the storytelling that it's doing, the big budget, bloodless destruction films. I mean, what was it? That movie 2012 essentially has billions of people dying, and it's just kind of, it's kind of brushed off and laughable at points. And no, yeah, it's just good popcorn fun. You know, billions of people dying. But all these films, and I've heard lots of people justify it. Well, you need to have massive destruction and a lot of death now to affect people because we're so numb to it. And
no.
Bullshit.
Actually, before The Walking Dead, one of the films that, like, in a long time at that time had really gotten to me was 28 Days Later. That film still stays with me as how harsh and dark and just really getting into the horrors of humanity, really. And I think that that's something that people are, quite frankly, afraid to explore. It's easier to blow up a building and just see a building fall and not think about the people in it than to really get into the psychology of the people experiencing something so terrible and having to make terrible decisions. And I think Lovecraft speaks to that.
I mean, what he does here is rather than the gigantic world, actually, this came into the editing of Whispers from the Abyss when Kat and I were selecting stories, is we specifically said we don't want any story where, you know, we get to see Cthulhu show up, where there's mass Hollywood destruction. We don't want that. We want the subtle. And we got lots of stories that we rejected where, you know, it was almost Godzilla-like, where the monster rises up and wrecks the city, or the universe blows up. It just goes on and on, right? And really, the effectiveness of Lovecraft was so many of these stories were about the person who got a glimpse of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It was told, you don't matter, and it's not going to be okay. And they have to go on living.
Knowing this.
Yeah.
Trying not to spoil it for those who might not have seen it, that's why True Detective was so good. Because,
except for that last episode. Or the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Last 10 minutes, no.
You know, True Detective got into that. Got into that you are being shown something that is so horrible, and now you get to live with it. You don't get the luxury of dying.
One of the things that is very popular right now is the concept of the cozy apocalypse, which the world ends, and it's not all that bad. It's an adventure. It's a libertarian fantasy where I get my bunker and my gun and, you know, I get to make my own rules, or liberal fantasy where, okay, now we're going to make society better and right and do it correctly this time. And, you know, it's all falling apart. Yay. And, you know, you see lots of suffering and death and horrible, but for our main characters, it's still kind of not that bad. And that is extremely popular right now. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, I've always said that, dystopians are far more terrifying than the apocalypse or post-apocalypse, because the reason being is that in a dystopian, you've got to live with it.
Yeah.
There is a tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You've got to deal with it.
I think that's part of why Hunger Games has become so popular.
Yeah.
I think it's because people that Battle Royale was really, really good, and if you steal from it, you're going to... Oh, wait, I keep making that point every time.
Yeah, Battle Royale. You know, that first Hunger Games movie, we read the book. I enjoyed the book. That first Hunger Games movie was terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. And if they had just stolen the opening from Battle Royale, it would have fixed half the plot.
Actually, what I love was years and years and years ago, I think I still have it, in issue of Player versus Player, they combined Battle Royale with Xanth.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
So, you know, you isolated the school and everybody had to fight each other, but everybody got special powers. And, you know, some people got things that were really ridiculously stupid. Like one guy had a snow globe for a head.
One guy could change the color of his urine.
Yeah, and that was in Xanth, actually. But I just thought that was genius combining those two things.
But so anyway...
So anyway, these are now the two projects I know about, the World War Kaiju and Whispers from the Abyss. Mm-hmm. And Josh, you've talked about how what you write tends to move to satire.
Well, recently, yes.
So what sort of, if 01 Publishing is going to have an identity, what would that identity be? Because when you look at certain smaller book publishers, these guys publish this, these guys publish this. I constantly talk about how Hard Case Crime, they are going to publish the 50s crime type stories and modern equivalents. If Elmore Leonard would have written it, it's going to show up there. If Donald Westlake would have written it, it would have shown up there. In fact, Donald Westlake's last two books, Hard Case Crime. So when I think 01 Publishing, what's sort of the overall philosophy of that publishing company?
Really, for me, my goal is to put out there the absolute best science fiction, fantasy, and horror that nobody has ever heard of, that nobody has experienced and would know, and people wouldn't normally be exposed to.
And pulls no punches.
And pulls no punches. And that's the other thing is, especially with what's going on in the science fiction and fantasy community, it disgusts me how much the social justice warriors have taken over a genre that should be reaching new heights and exploring new ideas and pushing boundaries and making people think.
No. We need a safe place. Safe space for everybody.
No, screw a safe place. You want a safe place?
It has to be a safe space for everybody.
Read Scholastic if you want a safe place. You know,
actually, Scholastic's more challenging than what we're getting out of a lot of the sci-fi publishers.
Yeah, it is. And that's the other thing is I find it very interesting that the only place that people can go to find books that challenge them right now is YA. The label YA allows people to get away with challenging.
Oh, of course,
things.
Because it's just for kids. You don't have to take it too seriously, Kat.
Oh,
if it offends you, it's just for kids. Don't worry about it.
Well, the other reason is...
And there's no sex.
And there's no sex, yes.
YA, that's the only category showing growth.
Yeah.
Well,
other categories in publishing, I've read a number of authors who said they have actually taken their books, rewritten them so they can sell them as YA, because if they would have sold them as a mystery or a science fiction book, they could count on a level of sales. If it's a YA book, because that's the hot thing right now, mm-hmm. movie people are looking at it, TV people are looking at it, you could expect B and C levels of sales.
Yeah. And
so how much of it's marketing as well?
Well, I think it's partially marketing. The thing about the movie companies all jumping on the bandwagon, that isn't going to last. But, you know, I think there's also a more depressing element of, well, it's YA, so it's written for 14-year-olds. So, unfortunately, that means a lot more people can understand it.
There's that, too. Fewer people read. Now,
well, that's changing, but...
It's changing, but in book sales...
Yeah.
One of the scandals that's happened over the last 10 years is this person put out an autobiography and it turned out to be fiction. Well, the reason for that is it used to be a young author would write a coming of age book and they could put it out and it would do reasonably well. Now no one buys those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say, well, this is what happened to me and it's the exact same story, you're going to get more. You're going to get on, the interview shows, you're going to get on the blogs, you're going to get people interested because, well, you're an interesting person rather than you wrote an interesting book.
Cult of celebrity. What did I say? The rock star mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but, you know, if it's a fantasy, it's a fantasy. But if it's a live person, people I found like to imprint onto things. They like to put themselves onto things, and that's how they relate to it. And one of the ways that they relate to it is these books like Eat, Pray, Love, Under a Tuscan Sun, where they have this idea
my narcissistic adventure all about me?
Yes, exactly. And if this person can have a narcissistic adventure all about me, then I can have a narcissistic adventure all about me. You know, it's not happening to some fantastic person, because if it's a fantastic person, then, you know, oh, that can never happen. You know, it takes the fun out of it, where I disagree. But anyway, but if it happened to somebody, suddenly it's that could happen to me and they can imprint on it.
One of the beauties of Cat Running 01 is that we're beholden to no one. We don't have to worry about appealing to the vast, huge horde of average readers, average audience.
Well, I don't want to say average.
I do.
Well, I don't. I am a very harsh critic. I will be very harsh and I will tell people to their face if I think they're full of it. But no, I value every one of our readers. And so I never want to say average.
No, I'll go a step further. We write books. We publish books for smart people.
I figure if someone there's something in our books. Well, okay, maybe not utopians, but I figure that there's something in our books for everybody to enjoy. Somebody can get something out of everything that we publish, and that is something that I love.
But,
because I will have people come to me with different facets of our books that they have enjoyed. Really, the only one that I would say that doesn't fit into that is Utopiates, and that is because it is so dark and it is so cerebral. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine.
But the thing is that at no point, unlike past experiences with publishers that wanted mass appeal, who won't be named because they don't want to get sued, I have never had to worry about movie producers and editors coming to me while under 01, unlike other publishers, saying, your work's too smart or too cerebral or too much thinking, too complex. Why can't you just kind of, you know, scale it back a bit, make it a bit more simple? The villain here is hard to identify. We need a Darth Vader type that we automatically know who's evil.
You know, I've had people do that to me since doing 01.
I had that constantly happening to me when I was under some other publisher.
At conventions, I will have people who, whether they are or are not Hollywood types, I do not know, but they will try to tell me how, you know, our stuff is great, but it sucks, and that's why I need to start producing their shit. It's like, nice.
No, but yeah, we had editors at other publishers we were under. We had movie producers as well that were with those publishers, constantly getting on my case, saying, mm-hmm. essentially, dumb down your work. It's too smart. Dumb it down.
Yeah, and then when you say, no, I'm not dumbing it down, then they'd say, okay, cut about 20 pages.
Yeah. And, you know, if you dumb it down, if you make it more simple, you know, we'll sell more. Guess what? We don't have to worry about selling to that audience. We've got the niche audience. That's enough.
Mm-hmm.
We can appeal to, you know, there's more than one audience out there. Smart people deserve books, too.
Exactly.
I'm going to get more coffee.
Okay.
Okay. I think that's a strong business strategy as well, okay. Because if you make a name for, and I'll just use World War Kaiju as an example,
mm-hmm.
on the level, you know what? It's a fun, funny comic with big monsters fighting shit and lots of explosions.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath, you've got the satiric level. You've got the stuff about, you've got the alternate universe aspect of it. You've got all this other stuff underneath. And then all of the back matter that this first book feels like the Criterion version. So I have not read Whispers from the Abyss because this summer I haven't had a chance to read much of anything that isn't something I can read during my lunch break.
Ah, well, hey, that's the thing with Whispers is that it was geared towards commuters and people who are working who don't have a lot of time to read. So all of the stories in Whispers are short for that very reason, actually.
That was one of the other things I wanted to bring up. You've published an anthology of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Short stories seem to have vanished from kind of our consciousness. I think New Yorker publishes a short story every week. And does Playboy still publish short stories?
I have no idea.
I think they do.
But
not sure.
Short stories seem to have gone away.
Well, that depends. Actually, with the digital market, they're starting to make a comeback. But major publishers, what it was major publishers found short stories and anthologies weren't profitable in their model, the way that they wanted to sell books. It wasn't that they weren't profitable. It was the method that they wanted to sell books. It wasn't profitable. Thanks to the digital market, there's been an explosion and a revival of the short story. And the way that we live our lives right now, it works. It works. It's a very good method of going about things.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of things do you have on the horizon for 01? As far as I know, you've got World War Kaiju, Whispers in the Abyss 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
Is there more in the pipeline?
Oh, yeah.
Is there more coming out?
Most definitely. Well, we got the rights back for Titanium Rain. So
we're trying to figure out how we're going to relaunch the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully sometime in 2015 we can make some form of an announcement on when Titanium Rain will make its triumphant return.
Then we'll print books 1 and 2 together.
Correct. We've got World War Kaiju Volume 2.
Okay.
You know, that is definitely on the calendar for 2015. Let's see here. We are doing a art book of
Friends Electric.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to probably sometime in 2015 do a quick Kickstarter to publish an art book of mine. Based on kind of a weird, crazy, cartoony robot art I do with kind of a loose narrative tied to it, that's entitled Friends Electric. It's very, very different from anything else I do.
Mm-hmm.
You'd pretty much have to see the work to kind of understand what I mean by that.
And last but not least, Josh and Patrick McAvoy, again, the artist from World War Kaiju, have a pulp Lovecraftian noir story that they have been
working on. Raymond Chandler wrote Lovecraft stories.
Exactly.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm. And so we plan on doing that next year.
Well,
so.
And then right now I've been heavily focused on just writing a lot of the prose short stories.
Yes. Yes. Josh personally has been writing a lot of short stories.
That was one of the questions I wanted to ask about. You've published comics and prose. What are the inherent differences both in publishing but also in the mindset when you go into this is what we're going to do? Are there things you do in prose you wouldn't do in comics and vice versa?
Well, do you mean marketing or do you mean creatively?
Both.
Oh, well, creative.
I've got the creative and the marketing person on the phone. Let's do both.
Creatively speaking, they're entirely different beasts. There's a lot of things you can do in comics that you can't do in prose, and vice versa. I mean, it's just a different approach to storytelling in general. I think one thing that's really harmed the creative arts, especially the storytelling arts, is this weird idea that everything is essentially a movie. That comics is a movie on paper. That novels are a movie without pictures. This ongoing idea has really hurt things. Comics especially, but there's also been a trend in horror where a lot of the young horror writers don't really know how to write prose. They don't really know how to write a narrative because what they're essentially writing is a screenplay on paper or in novel form. And it's just each medium has its own inherent strengths and its own inherent weaknesses. And so in that sense, if I was to tell a story like Kaiju or Titanium Rain, well, Kaiju's unique because it's kind of a hybrid, but if I was to take any of my comic stories and do it as prose, it would have a totally different beginning, the sequence of events would be different, the monologues, the medias are so utterly and vastly unique, you can't really compare them.
Well, also from a marketing standpoint, this is something I find very interesting. People are used to prose. So prose is actually very approachable, and you get a lot more people interested in your ideas with prose. However, people are also very visual thinkers. You know, if they can see something, they can grasp the idea better. So coming to someone with just the idea of World War Kaiju will get a mildly interested. You show them a picture of Fat Man, you know, blowing up Tokyo, or you show them a picture of, you know, of a red armadillo. Sometimes you don't even have to tell them anything. Just show them the picture, and they are on board with it. Yet, even with the popularity of comic book movies and graphic novels, at least in America, becoming more of a mainstream idea, people are kind of leery about taking a chance on a graphic novel. Well, they'll flip through it and they'll see the pictures and they think, wow, this looks really good, but do I really want to chance the story because there's a weird stigma to it? So it's...
Well, the other thing with the prose audience, despite all the bizarre politics and infighting and just the really toxic environment that's occurring right now in the lit scene... by and large, the readership is, let's be brutal. It's a bit smarter, mm-hmm. more open to far out and challenging ideas, and are more patient. Unfortunately, right now, with this whole geek chic crap going on, the comic book scene, the mainstream comics, not the ancillary audiences that we're trying to reach, but the main comic book scene is so flooded with tourists and pedestrian geeks. I'll be brutal. I don't care. I know a lot of you are not supposed to say that, but these pedestrian geeks, that we're finding that, yeah, a lot of people really aren't there to read. They're just there for the spectacle, for the freak show. And I know that there's that line, oh, we should be inclusive to everyone. Oh, we shouldn't shut anyone out. Oh, you're just being elitist. Well, yeah, yeah, fuck you guys. I'm a writer. If you don't read, I don't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if I was a vendor who just sold stuff, yeah, I'd love it. But I'm a writer. If you're not there to buy books and read and enjoy the medium, yeah, yeah, you're a phony. Get out.
Well, I will say that some of the vendors are kicking their heels up too, saying, look, I'm here and I'm not making money. I always go back to Chuck Rosansky, who's a terrible poker player, and I love him to death because of it. I've made money over the years off Chuck. But Chuck every year talks about how San Diego, he can't sell books, he can't sell books, he can't sell books. Joe and I, before our convention, there was an artist who, you know, I'm not making money at these conventions. And then they list the conventions and it's, well, of course you're not going to make money at those conventions because their guest of honor is William Shatner and Doctor Who and Actor A and Actor B and Actor C and Actor D. And if you go to a comic book convention, which is a different animal,
yes,
it really is. It's a different animal as an artist. As a vendor, you're going to make money. Now, the science fiction convention world, I know nothing about. The anime convention world, I know nothing about. I'm not a big convention person.
I would say everything you've said is true up until this year. This year, you know, was really weird for us. We've seen a real noted change in a lot of the convention turnout, even to comics conventions that should have been profitable. Where they were either, you know, it was a comics convention, but it was promoted primarily to cosplayers and Big Bang Theory fans and,
and pedestrians.
Pedestrians, people that were just there to kind of show up, take pictures in their costumes and kind of treat it like an amusement park and expect everything free. You know, okay. I don't really show up to sit and listen to some weirdo talk to me about My Little Pony for an hour and a half. While they pose for pictures at my table saying, yeah, there's this whole thing where we're having problems with cosplayers getting harassed. And there are those signs that say cosplay doesn't mean consent. I keep joking that I want a sign from me that says, you know, if you sit on my book, you have to buy it. Because I'm so sick of cosplayers, you know, sticking their bare asses on our table to post photographs. You sit on it,
thankfully,
you buy it.
Thankfully, one of the things we do is we have set up an area for that at the Minnesota convention. Actually, the cosplayer group was started by a couple of guys who started as kind of vendors. A guy built his own Batmobile. And the guy who is Superman is a personal trainer. And they would buy tables and set up their area, and it keeps getting bigger. So we don't have the people wandering around for pictures. It's, oh, no, come over here. Take pictures with all of our cosplay merchandise and stuff. And if conventions are smart.
They do that.
Get the cosplayers to spend money by having costumers and people selling the stuff involved over there.
Well, something happened, too, because up until recently, I would say most cosplayers that came to conventions were hardcore. They were fans. They read the books. They were familiar with the characters. But again, we're getting this pedestrian atmosphere where a lot of people are showing up cosplaying, and they have no love of the medium. They haven't. A lot of them aren't even fully aware of the characters they're dressing as.
We actually, at the Long Beach Comic Con, had somebody who had no clue who they were dressed as. Couldn't tell you what it was from. Couldn't tell you anything.
Yeah.
And that's why I show up every year as the best-dressed man in comics.
Exactly.
But
so where do you see publishing going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Nobody knows.
I know that I was one of the people who digital. No, I want to feel the book. I want to hold the book. I want the book in my hand. And then I realized how much shit there is in my house. And it's no. Give me the digital. So that when I'm done, I don't have to put it in a box and put it in a storage unit or find a place on a shelf or something. do you think digital's going to continue to grow, or because digital's great for niche?
Yeah. Well,
or do you think publishing is going to get so cheap that anybody can do it?
Oh, it's already gotten so cheap that anybody can do it. And what we're finding is just because you can do it doesn't mean they'll do it well, or they'll do it effectively, or stay on it. Just because you have the resources to do it, the actual will and drive to produce good comics, to get out there and do the work, to write the stories, that hasn't changed. There's a reason that the good stuff floats to the top, because, well, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
But as far as digital, I think we're in a weird space right now. I think for print, for prose books, the literature world, it's been wonderful. It's been everything that was promised. It's opened the doors. Digital works really, really well for prose. Although people still are demanding hard copies, so that market isn't disappearing despite what anyone says. The comics world, on the other hand, I hate to say it, just like everything else the comics infrastructure has tried, they fucked it up. We had a lot of hopes for it. I think it might take Amazon fixing it before it's really going to take off. We've tried with multiple digital publishers, and the one thing was is they first all seem to have the LCS mindset. They want to be the local comic book store online. They're still appealing to that mainstream, superhero clubhouse feel. And that's really hurt, for one thing. The other thing is that they've been so poorly organized that first we were with, can I name the company because it's no longer in business?
Or, yeah.
First it was Graphically.
Mm-hmm.
Graphically's
still around.
Yeah, got everything set up. Horrible job. They were more trouble than it was worth. Then we got set up with Iverse. And I honestly can't understand how we could have.
Well, let me talk actually for all of this, because I'm actually handling all this.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Comics, from what I am seeing, I'm not a Nostradamus. I'm not going to predict the market, but I'm just going to tell what I see. And from what I see is this. If you are in the top 20 comic publishers, if you have a deal with one of them and you're happy with your deal and, you know, all of that, go with it, because they are doing great both print and digitally, as, you know, the numbers show. Or at least they're turning a profit to some extent. If you are a creator and you have your idea out there, actually what I would say is do the model of make your work, put it out there for free. Do a web comic. Build a name for yourself. Build an audience. Build a loyal fan base. Because that loyal fan base is going to stay with you from project to project to project, no matter what you do, no matter what you move on to. And I follow several webcomics where this one girl, she got horribly sick, had these awful hospital bills. And I'm talking.
Yeah, it's Patrick. He wants to join us.
Hey, Patrick, you want to join us?
And there you go. As I said, it cuts off a little abruptly. And sadly, we don't hear more about who the web artist was. Next week, we finish up the interview. The week after that, I will be interviewing longtime web strip artist and a friend of mine, Jin Wicked. I also have some other interviews coming up. I have some interviews with people you have never heard of. I have some interviews with people I know who aren't comic book fans. The rest of this year is going to be rather busy because my work schedule has lessened up a bit. I want to thank everyone for their support, and I want to mention my advertisers right here. Every podcast has ads.
and this one is no different. We have some fine sponsors. Our first sponsor is DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the web host that I use, and if you need a website, you should use them too. And if you use the code CRAYZ, K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year of hosting. Graze.com is healthy snacks sent to you in the mail. I use it. Let's see. This week I got a scrumptious blueberry swirl, which was blueberry yogurt raisins, raspberry-infused cranberries, and black currants. Sour cream and onion cashews, which are amazingly good. Seed sational, which was roasted pumpkin and sunflower seeds with soy sauce. I'd never even thought to do that. And herby bread basket, which is mini basil bread sticks, garlic crostini, and oregano rice crackers. You can get snacks like this too. They're sent to you every 2 weeks. They're healthy. They're good for you. And if you use the code CORYS3R5P, your first and fifth box are free. Our last sponsor is Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club, if you're a guy, you're probably going to have to shave. Go to dollarshaveclub.com/crazy. You can certainly email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. You can call us at 952-856-0519, or you can go to the Facebook page, which is Solitaire Rose Radio. We appreciate all feedback. If you would like to advertise, you can. Just send me an email at corey.strode@gmail.com, subject advertising. Thank you, and back to the show. Thanks again for downloading this episode, and we'll be back next week with more stories.